There are perhaps very few museums that are so strongly linked to the identity of the very buildings that it actually is housed in, like the Hamburger Bahnhof.
The micro approach for us seems to be the most valid, and from there on generate the questions that could then be answered within a different context while respecting these differences.
Say Sam Badawi and Till Fellrath, who we visited for another episode of Kunstpause, the podcast of Freunde der Nationalgalerie Stoberkreis. Today I'm together with my colleague Michael Krieger.
Hi.
Hello, Michael. And we are very happy to be sitting in the office of Sam and Till at Hamburger Bahnhof. You are very active in the contemporary art scene already since 2 decades. You just opened an exhibition here in Berlin at Martin Gropius Bau. You are about to open the Lyon Biennale in September. You curated together the French Pavilion at the Venice Biennale this year, which is absolutely worth a visit to all of our listeners. And most importantly, you're heading now Hamburger Bahnhof Museum für Gegenwart. This is one of the reasons why we are very happy to be at your office now and discuss with you this institution, your vision of it, and because our listeners are Freunde der Nationalgalerie and their friends, and we are happy to have you in this episode. Obviously, we know a lot about your activities, but we don't know so much about the very beginnings. When the first maybe magic moment when you did not know each other yet, what drew you first into the field of the arts? When did you decide I need to work in that field, whether it be as an artist creator or whether it be as a curator? When did you first feel, Sam, this is my habitat?
Well, basically the story goes back to Lebanon. I was around 16 years old, and I remember at the time it was just a few years after the end of the civil war. And I remember seeing an exhibition that was looking at, just stumbling upon an exhibition that was looking at artists from different countries who were actually using their art in order to protest against all forms of injustice. And I remember experiencing a very, very powerful emotion that was going beyond, you know, intellectual faculties. It was more about gutturally understanding immediately on a very human, almost primordial level, an experience that is so personal, yet at the same time felt so universal. And this is where I, for the first time, felt I wish I could actually be in an environment in the future where I could generate similar experiences for myself, but also for other people, that through the language of art and through the power of art, you could actually bring people together and put their differences aside for 1 second and focus on the things that connect them in a way. And this is basically where my lifelong, until now, search continues. I studied art history, I studied theater, I was working in the performing arts, and then I was teaching art history and performance studies at NYU in New York. This is actually the context in which I met Till back in 2008. And you know, since then, of course, we've been working together and doing so many projects. But it all started from a very personal encounter that was truly life-changing, in a sense, where you feel the power of an artwork in bringing people together and highlighting the complexity of the human experience.
What was your way, Till?
Well, I also maybe can share a little anecdote from my early childhood. My parents had a lot of artist friends, and I remember specifically that one of them painted an image of my brother and I, in which I am actually standing in front of a painting of my brother. So the painting is a double thing. But what I remember specifically about it, that he painted me with a hat that I didn't have and that didn't really exist. And I was so puzzled by that fact. And I remember specifically that it really is something that somehow takes you out of who you think you are and can kind of make you reflect on your own reality in a different way. And it sort of really puzzled me for a long time, that painting. I thought it wasn't right, and, you know, how can this be? And it took a long time, in a sense, to reconcile that. But it somehow stayed with me. It's maybe a small funny anecdote, but it had a profound impact, I think, in terms of how you can actually change perception and how you can change a reality and how people imagine a reality in the art, and that really it is limitless in the end. And I also played instruments growing up, piano and oboe, and I remember specifically these universes that you lose yourself in. And then I studied actually economics and business and I was a bit far removed, and I enjoy that very much and I really love economics as a field and as a discipline. But I also felt that this was not something I want to do for the rest of my life, so I actually stopped it all and I was at a teaching position at the LSE in London and decided I'm going back to art school. And I took a year just painting, drawing, and just did something that was completely out of my comfort zone just to have
painting
fun.
Painting shouldn't be seen by anyone.
Well, I was hoping the Strobers could acquire them at one point.
For the hamburger bottle. Yes.
But it's a sense of freedom, you know, and I think what you learn is to lose judgment that you have in many, many industries and many, many disciplines, that there's a right or a wrong. In the arts, that really doesn't exist. That objectivity, you can change and you can reinvent and there is no value.
And art is really able to put a head on someone's head. That is not there. That's the beauty of this image. You once formulated, Sam, that Till brings the logic and you bring the heart. Would you agree, Till? Don't you have a heart as well?
Of course. I think it's exactly the opposite, actually. But I think you need to have both in all seriousness. And I think we struggle sometimes when people ask, you know, who does what and really saying that. I think it really changes a lot on the projects. It changes a lot on... you know, the context or whom you're working with in a particular field. And I do think that we both share similar values. And sometimes maybe somebody is very passionate about something and then the other one says stop. And sometimes it is exactly the other way around, you know, to kind of... and I think you need this dialectic probably to do a successful project.
Yeah. Definitely. I mean, dialectic also means positivity in conflicts. How do you fight with each other? If you fight, I imagine there needs to be fights.
Yeah, we call them very committed conversation. I mean, it's. I think at the end of the day, collaborating in all forms, ultimately for it to be successful, requires two very important components. I think one is humility, because in a way you can't take every moment where somebody disagrees with you as a personal attack or a rejection. You have to understand that while your ideas are certainly the best ideas in the world, somebody else might have a valid criticism or a valid way of trying to make you think about things differently, and that requires humility. And I think on the other hand, the other very important component is basically trust. Because it's one thing to be humble and listen, but you also want to know that the person that you're collaborating with is someone that you can trust, because you know that they have the project's best interest at heart. It's not about your ego, it's not about what you only have to say, but it's about how what I and you and her and everyone can bring to the table. So we build something that's much more rich and much more complex, and could also connect to different people because it's built by different people and different opinions. And I think this is basically what we try to keep in mind every time we go through these committed conversations, that we need to step back, take a breather, and rethink the project, rethink what we're doing. And it's always fascinating how things can get richer and deeper and even more exciting when you allow yourself to kill your favorite idea and move forward.
So collaboration is very contemporary in the working field, for sure, in every business, I would say. Would you say it's a big advantage of you both that you are not alone working on projects, but you have more brain cells than the single person working on it?
Definitely. At the end, if you collaborate in a group and if it works well, then the sum is always greater than its individual parts. And that's exactly what we're striving for in our own collaboration. But we've also done this in all the other projects that we have been working on. And it is, in fact, really the essence of human existence, I actually think. You know, you probably need maybe a certain leadership or a vision that somebody can carry a group to a certain part. That is perhaps the rule of maybe leading an institution as well. But it is only possible, actually, when you really look at it as a team project and a team effort. And for that, you need to involve the security guards as much as the person that is installing the artwork, the artists and the staff and the visitors as well. They all have to feel they are taken care of, that it is a safe place. It is a place for discussion, participation, and a true space of encounters, you know, where everybody feels like this is our show, this is our museum, and this is what we are hoping to achieve. So in that sense, it is perhaps revolutionary, but I actually think it is really the basis of what has been happening in successful organization and projects all along.
When you work together with these artists, do they also perceive you as a team, or is it sometimes the case that they are more connected to Sam or to Till, depending on how you got to know them? I imagine, for example, now
the collaboration with Zineb Dedira in Venice.
It looked like there's a very strong personal relationship to the both of you. There is, for those who look closely, there is cameos of you in the film that is projected, lovely scenes. Tell me about this particular case, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, it's always natural that sometimes people click better with certain people. So in a way, it depends on every project and who the artist is. And that also allows us to sometimes maybe even challenge the artist better or allow for a more comfortable and positive working environment to develop. Sometimes you have to play good cop and bad cop, and sometimes you have to, you know, be the one who listens, and then the other person is the one who speaks about what needs to be done. But I think what all artists know when they work with us is that it's not like they can come to me so that they can do something that Till might not agree with. I think it's clear to all of them that we operate as one entity, one voice, one opinion, one position. But the process of getting towards the end result, which is definitely not only the curatorial vision, but in this case it's about the artist and the curator. Actually, it's more about the curator empowering the artist and providing them with the platform to fulfill what they want to do best. So you challenge them, you critique them, not because you want your voice to be overpowering, but because you want them to really consider every possibility and arrive to a conclusion that is truly well thought through and very, very strong. So in that sense, they know that we're both equally invested in giving them all the support that they need. And it should be about the artist, and it should be about pushing them to the next level, not pushing them over the edge. It's a very thin line between the two.
Usually in this podcast we talk about a certain artwork from the collection. In your particular case, it makes much more sense to speak about the entire institution of Hamburger Bahnhof. Maybe not so much the institution, but the building to start with. In particular, because obviously a director of a museum can't have a favorite piece. That's one of the reasons, but also because you have a very clear vision of how to work with that building, with all its history. It starts with its natural function, or its former function, more to say, which was, as not all of our listeners know, a Bahnhof. I mean, it's obviously known, but yeah. Tell us about this idea of the train station that you will try to build on your vision for the upcoming years.
Yeah, I mean, as the title suggests, you know, it has been a train station, or the main part of the building, we should probably say more specifically, was conceived as a train station for the trains going from Berlin to Hamburg. So still some people think that we're moving to Hamburg, you know, but actually it's the trains that would have gone to Hamburg. The notion of a train station, a Bahnhof, is some sort of a leitmotif actually for what we're planning to do. It is a space of encounter. It is a space where perhaps some people arrive to leave on a vacation to visit some friends. Other people might arrive at the same time with a plastic bag on their hands because they're fled a war situation and come here as refugees and so on. And it is a place where people come back to. We are next to the train station, the main station of Berlin, that counts 300,000 passengers per day. So train stations are really busy places of encounter, and people bring experiences, hopes, dreams, aspirations maybe with them, or daily routines, frustrations. So this is a bit of a leitmotif where we see the museum as well as a place of such encounters, of voices that come together, of having these conversations and maybe share them and learn from one another. And there are perhaps very few museums that are so strongly linked to the identity of the very buildings that it actually is housed in, like the Hamburger Bahnhof. You know, when we look at the Riekhallen, with its strange layout and its connection as a former warehouse, but also the site of former artist studios, including some really famous names like, you know, Olof Eliasson or Thomas Saraceno, for example, but also the main building that very quickly was turned into a museum of transportation. So the main architecture, the main hall, was never a museum, never a train station hall, but it was always designed to house locomotives, not for trains coming in and out, but simply to display them in a traffic museum. And these histories and the fact that it lies next to the former border between East and West Berlin makes it a very fascinating structure and something that is a historical monument at the same time, where we want to talk about that history and use it as a projection space and a concept for artists and their works. It is a historically charged location. It is a location that has a very unique architecture, and it is part of the National Gallery. And all these different parts are ideal, confrontation lines, if you will, for programs and artists to even create new works.
What you've just been saying also ultimately has to do with the fact that a train station of a city is very local bound. At the same time, it's like a sensor that brings in all other identities, nationalities, people from outside, whatever outside means. That is obviously a topic which I feel you are working on, in particular on the current projects that I could discover, whether it's the Baruth exhibition in the Gropiusbau, whether it's the French Pavilion. Is there a kind of a red line that you would say that through very local stories you try to picture global stories? Is that a curatorial approach?
I think we're pretty... I can speak for ourselves, obviously, that the micro approach for us seems to be the most valid approach. And this is not to undermine other ways of thinking about how do you excavate, uncover, put into value those unknown stories, whether it's stories of individuals, of cities, of places, of histories. Art history being only one form of history. I think our approach has been always, instead of doing these comparative presentations between so many different things and places and objects and people, and take a more kind of horizontal, on the surface kind of panorama, to actually spend a lot of time digging into specifics of one particular place, one particular incident, one particular story, but truly study it, and then be able to flesh out and project from that particular case questions and propositions that could then be relevant to so many different cultures, geographies. So you respect the specificity of each place, because sometimes when you generalize and you place artists from different places just because they all come from not Europe, you know, or you look at art history and you think of the 50s as a global phenomena everywhere, you risk diluting the very specific socio-political and cultural and human conditions that shaped a place. So I think for us it's very important to follow that micro approach and from there on generate the questions that could then be answered within a different context while respecting these differences.
So a train station is also a place of movement, of arriving and departure, and a public museum is more an institution perceived as a heavy, slow thing. How do you bring this both aspects together?
Well, yes. I mean, these institutions are often a bit, like an ocean vessel or a tanker, you know. And but it is certainly our intention to transform it into a speedboat. So we think it should be really much more active, and especially a museum of contemporary art that sits at the forefront of artistic production. And in fact, our responsibility will also be to grow the collection with those positions that in 30, 50 or 100 years will offer maybe the panorama of what was now the forefront of artistic creation and what was going on in the city, what is happening with this institution. So it has a long-term vision. But in general, museums really need to become much more part of their communities and not stuffy old visual libraries, you know, that close when the museum door closes and people see, you know, labels, and it's a very didactic approach. They need to really transform themselves into something that matters to people that come, that really are part of shaping a community, that are an active instigator of conversations, of bringing people together. And as such, there is a lot of transformation that needs to happen in these institutions. If it doesn't happen, there is also a danger in them simply not becoming relevant anymore, and people stop caring about them. The way we look at art, the way we discuss topics, the way we see images in social media, and everything is changing so dramatically. And the job, I think, for us in the next years will be to not catch up with that, but actually be part of that transformation process and try to maybe even anticipate it for the future, so the museum is fully relevant in 30 years from now.
That's a great and very responsible way of describing your job. you are both used to working on project-based structures and on structures such as biennials, which are more of a project-based spirit. What are the biggest challenges that you see in your new position as being part of an institution which is called Staatliche Museen zu Berlin, which is part of Stiftung Preußischer Kulturbesitz? So it's an institution within an institution within an institution with very clear structures, with not that fluidity and possibly speed and lightness that you need to have when you practice on a biennial structure, for example. Where do you see the biggest differences, challenges, and why do you think Hamburger Bahnhof can profit from your outside experiences?
Well, I think that the challenge and the advantage are probably so intertwined in this case that you can't say this is where it becomes a challenge and this is where it's actually a strength. I think the fact that we have operated on a vast, you know, array of projects with so many different types of institutions, from the very small scale to the very, very large encyclopedic museum, to the artist-run not-for-profit, to a private, privately initiated museum, to governmental agencies, and so on and so forth, ministries of culture, etc. I think this has allowed us such a repertoire of institutional models, like the knowledge and accessibility to the workings of such a diverse repertoire of how different institutions operate, which means that every time you face a hurdle in this particular institution, you can draw on solutions that you have seen working in similar cases in other places. So I feel our job, as much as it is to run this institution, is also to instigate a sort of repair, a sort of reform, if you can use that word, also within these institutional structures. We don't see ourselves only as coming here to make an exhibition that's successful. I think, in a sense, that's probably the easier part. I see that our job is equally to bring the expertise that we've had, learning how to work with so many different types of institutions, and infuse that into the way the bigger structures are formed and dismantled and reimagined. And this is definitely something that does not happen in 6 months or 2 years even. This is something that has to be thought of as an ongoing process. Sometimes, yes, you need to be patient, because we're also very, very adamant on making things happen quickly, and in some cases I'm sure we will, and in other cases it will take a little longer, but it's a matter of perception, and it's a matter of us making it clear to everyone that we're working on that we are intent on creating this change.
And this implies obviously a lot of politic groundwork, I guess, lobbying, if we may use that term. How do you fit all of these different tasks into your day, and how do you...
But you're right, it takes also a lot of people in large organizations to move things forward, and we are very much making an effort also to meet all those people and bring them on board, you know, and it may take longer to move things, but I think it's ultimately also more successful, because you really get everyone on board and you have much more power to do things. And even within larger rigid structures, it is sometimes possible to move things surprisingly quickly. For example, the Berlin Biennale collaboration is something that we were able to actually figure out within a matter of a few weeks, right when we started. So in a sense, that is something that we were able to realize very successfully in a very short amount of time. And it is really wonderful that we have this collaboration here in the Rikhal. And just this weekend, yesterday, we had almost 3,000 visitors in the museum. And it is great that sometimes you can make people realize when there is an opportunity to act quickly, and it works. So if the goals align, and that is very much what we are trying to do, you are able to move things forward in a very constructive way.
Sam, what will we be able to visit during the Berlin Biennale here in the Rikhallen? Because the podcast is going to be aired within the period of Biennale. Tell us about the positions we can discover.
Yeah, I mean, there's plenty of positions ranging from photography to video to painting to tapestries, textile art. I think one of the very, very powerful pieces that is on view, and we're a little bit biased maybe because we're also working with this artist for Lyon and have seen this work on several occasions. There is a beautiful film by Clément Cogitore. He's a French artist who lives here in Berlin, and it's based on Les Indes Galantes, the famous opera. But it's a collaboration with a choreographer where they worked with street dancers. So it's a very, very rough form of movement. And the whole film is shot as if you're standing with those street dancers using your iPhone to basically capture that energy. So you're in the middle of the energy and you feel that kind of resistance, you feel that power coming from those dancers. This is a very, very powerful work, I think. There's also a beautiful, very poetic piece by Basil Abbas and Rawan Abu Rahmi, which is a very, very strong work. Very, very beautiful in terms of the installation because it fragments the projections and they become really like compartments hanging on the wall. So these are two works that I really, really enjoyed looking at. And they are both also very powerful politically and socially.
For those who missed Berlin Biennale, they will be able to discover Lyon Biennale, yes. Opening in September. You already presented the concept, which I found in particular, very interesting because of Louise Brunet, this character. Tell me about this character and the underlying curatorial concept of the Lyon Biennale. Obviously, there will be a lot of positions invited as well, but there is a particular approach of you inventing this character of Louise.
Yeah, Louise Brunet is a actual historical character that we came across while doing research on the history of the city, which is something we always do every time we start a project. We like to immerse ourselves in the local context and understand what can you pull out that relates to your immediate kind of environment, to your community where the project is going to happen.
Again, the micro approach in a way.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it was fascinating to discover this woman who was a silk weaver that took part in the revolt of the silk weavers against the rich merchants in 1834, to find herself then sent to prison and then come out not being able to find work. She ends up going to work in a silk factory in Lebanon. Ironically, this is where I come from, so it makes it even more exciting, the connections between Lyon and Beirut historically. And for us, this woman became not only a way of connecting to Lyon, but also a way of thinking about fragility, which is the main kind of theme, in a sense, of the Biennale, which is titled Manifesto of Fragility. A woman who reinvents herself, who finds ways to resist, and stand up against all forms of social and economic and gender oppression, in a sense. So she became a fil conducteur. She became like a metaphor for many people who could have experienced their own fragility, but then tried to resist in their own way in different times and in different places. So starting from the story of Louise, we open up to the story of a city, which is Beirut. That's the city that Louise ends up in when she goes there. And then from Beirut, we open up to the rest of the world. So it's looking at fragility from the micro, which is the person, to a city a little bit expanded, and then to the rest of the world. Forms of fragility and resistance, and how fragility becomes a way of rethinking our relationship to each other and to the world in which we live.
Hopping around between all these places, you're finally about to find a place here in Berlin. Do you collect art? Are you collectors yourselves? Do you live with art, or do you need a very empty apartment?
We live with art, No, we live with art. I mean, simply because that's all we do in our free time. We're always in museums. We always see art and just, you know, speak to artists, people that are surrounded by art. But I don't know if I would say that we're collectors. You know, we're not engaging in the, you know, in the habit of buying art or something, because it's something that is somehow not how we think. You know, it's not a conscious decision, but we've never really been in a position that we bought artworks in a gallery or from a studio or something. We're just so passionate about thinking these concepts and telling those stories that this is really never anything that happens. Mm-hmm. However, what, you know, we have, I guess you could say, assembled a collection is, you know, we were friends with a lot of artists, and there are sometimes gifts that you get, or, you know, from a project or certain memorabilia.
Remains, yeah.
Yeah, remains that are very, very personal. And those are certain objects that, you know, we then live with in a personal manner. So I don't know if I would call it a collection, but maybe just more like some kind of a memoir, or like a, you know.
It's a diary that hangs on the wall and sits in the corners instead of being in a book.
So it is it's a personal story in that sense, you know, but I think buying and selling art is really not something that is our concern.
And I mean, you have access to the storages of Nationalgalerie, which are filled with art.
I don't think we can convince them to put them in our own home, but...
However, that's one of the tasks which you are also having in the upcoming years, that storage is full of great and quality art, it's having many, many blind spots, right?
Well, this is for sure. I mean, ultimately, every collection maybe has inevitably the problem that it's not complete, because it can never be complete. So you will never be able to get to a collection that is objective, all-encompassing. And what our job will be also to find that red line, or figuring out how do we want to present it and talk about it. There certainly is some more work to be done in raising the awareness that Hamburger Bahnhof is the contemporary part of the National Gallery. And this is certainly a focus that we will place over the next years, in describing that and telling the story, perhaps, of Berlin as an art city, and what has been happening, what are the great positions that have been created here over the last 20, 30 years, and showing that, you know, so that when you're an artist living here, an art lover or a collector or international visitor, or anyone that just wants to learn a little bit about what is that Berlin art scene like, that is something that we'll be able to see, hopefully, in the Hamburger Bahnhof in the future. You have this when you go to the Tate, you have it when you go to Centre Pompidou in Paris, perhaps, and in many other cities. But in Berlin, really, we still need that big central location that is anchoring the community in the arts, and that will be the story. And that means that we can, you know, maybe mirror positions from other places in the world, but I think there needs to be that grounding and that strong telling of that story. And you're absolutely right, there are many gaps. We need to look at the typical important question of gender, but we need to look at the question of artists from western part of Germany and those that have a biography in the eastern part of the country. But we need to also take into account that as an institution, we are in a city that has been part of a migrant society for decades now, and that, like many other places in the country, have 30% residents that do not have a German passport, that have one parent that is born abroad. That figure is rising to 50% with the projections by the end of the decade. So we need to really ask ourselves the question, what is the nation and what is the collection? And we need to look like the city that we are in, and we need to look like the global arts world that we're engaging with. So these corrective decisions will certainly have to be taken for the next years and decades to come. Yeah.
So the German society changed a lot within the last few years. Like you said, that the biographs are very different, and also new people coming to Germany, like the train station picture we had former. And how do you find this exciting new positions or former positions of older artists to fill in the blind spots?
I mean, I think it's more than finding, it's about continuing certain conversations and relationships, because you know, there's a word that gets thrown around a lot in art circles, which is like, oh, we discovered, you know, this word discovery, that people discover artists and discover cities and discover art histories.
It's creating a hierarchy.
And it's also very patronizing, because it's as if, you know, China only exists when I visit it. And I think that it's these words are very, very misleading. So in a way, we're always open to encounters, and we don't talk about discoveries. And an encounter comes without a hierarchy, because it's a meeting of two positions, and they can meet on the same level and inform each other. And I think these are the kind of artists and the kind of practices that excite us the most. It doesn't mean that... it doesn't matter where they come from, although of course you're conscious about the fact, as Till was saying, we are living in a very global society, but sometimes global yet segregated society. It doesn't mean that we're all living together. We come to one place and we all live next to each other, and that's very different. It's not truly a melting pot. So in a way, we are aware of all these things, and we are continuing conversations that we've had with a lot of artists and a lot of curators and colleagues as well, who have a lot of knowledge and expertise. And this is something we value a lot, that an institution cannot generate everything internally. There's no way you can know everything. And there are artists and or curators or researchers that are working independently, similar to how we've operated for a long time, that have accumulated so much knowledge and expertise because they are committed to certain histories or stories or practices. And you need to... The Hamburger Bahnhof would be so much more exciting if it allows for these practices and these experts to come in and inform your knowledge and inform your program and inform what you do. So we're not planning on just working internally and generating everything. The idea is to open up this, and it's a platform for these individuals who have a legitimate and expertise in a lot of great things.
So in a way, it all comes down to being open to wearing a different hat from time to time.
That
to stay with that image
of
your
childhood.
Well, absolutely. It's something that people should constantly, I think, or can benefit from constantly questioning that a little bit. You know, you always can go deeper or have a different blind spot. And simply being open to different points of view and different perspectives is really probably one of the core qualities that you can have in a rapidly changing world, and not taking things for given, and really just trying to understand when people have a different reality they're coming from, that this is equally relevant and equally right or wrong or whatever, but it's their reality. And figuring out how to reconcile it is also the big task that we will face in our societies in the future. You know, we're drifting apart and there are increasing polarizations, but we need to be careful that this doesn't become something that really, in the end, undermines the institution that we all cherish and value. So there is a big task ahead of us, all of us collectively.
And it's a spice to the soup we are all eating from.
Yes. Absolutely.
Thanks a lot for the conversation.
Thanks a lot. Thank you for these wonderful questions. And
thank you for the invitation.
Pleasure.
Yes.
Pleasure.
And we hope everyone will come to the Hamburger Bahnhof very soon.